a criminal, we wouldn't have handed him over to you. So Pilate told them, you take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. Therefore the Judeans said to him, it is not lawful for us to put anyone to death. This was to fulfill the statement of Jesus, which he made to indicate what sort of death he was going to die. Then Pilate went back into the headquarters, called Jesus, and said to him, are you king of the Judeans? Jesus answered him, are you saying this on your own, or have others told you about me? Pilate replied, I'm not a Judean, am I? Your own nation and chief priests handed you over to me. What have you done? My kingdom is not of this world, Jesus answered. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I wouldn't be handed over to the Judeans. But in fact, my kingdom does not have its source here. So Pilate said to him, are you a king then? You say that I am a king. Jesus replied, for this I was born, and for this I have come into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Pilate said to him, what is truth? And when he had said this, he went out to the Judeans again and told them, I find absolutely no grounds for charging him. But you have a custom that I release one man to you at the Passover. So do you want me to release the king of the Jews for you? Then they all shouted back, not this fellow, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a bandit. Most of you know that we go traveling around the country with our Dodge Dually diesel, carrying lots of these little living water booklets. We're getting scheduled for a trip where we're going to be distributing at least 10,000 of them. But one night, my truck whispered to me that when it grew up, it wanted to be a Mac. Just imagine how many living waters we could haul then. I don't know if you know the mascot of Mack Truck Company, the Bulldog. And do you know how it got the insignia or the Bulldog as its mascot? Well, back during World War I, there were a fair number of Mack trucks that were sent over to Europe as vehicles for handling all sorts of war material. And the Brits started saying that the Mack AC truck was as ugly as a bulldog, but it really worked. Well, you know, there was another bulldog over there in Europe a few years later by the name of Winston Churchill. And I don't know if you are aware of this, but he had a granddaughter by the name of Celia Sandys. And when she was a little girl, one day during World War II, he gave her a toy bulldog. And she kind of wondered, why would he give her as a gift a toy bulldog? So she asked her mother. And her mother said, well, it's because they call him the bulldog. And she set about her life trying to figure out why it was that her beloved grandfather was called the bulldog, a term that he obviously also enjoyed. One of his famous speeches they delivered at the school where he had graduated. He told the young men, never, never, never give in. He was the bulldog. As we look at our passage today that we are going to be considering, we are going to see the strength of character of Jesus Christ, who never, never, never gave in. And we are going to see the character of the religious officials who gave in very quickly because they were jealous of Jesus. And they were willing to stand up against him, against all principle, and yet at the same time maintain that they were innocent and should not be defiled. Who would go to the Passover feast and be able to celebrate it in good conscience? And we will also see Pilate, who stood up initially for principle, but he also very quickly gave in. The question that Jesus was asked by Pilate, "What is truth?" says much about what is going on here. Only one of the characters that is involved here stood for truth, and the truth that he stood for was worth dying for. Now, if we need to go into a little bit of background, we looked last week at the trials before Annas and Caiaphas that Jesus had that were at night. We pointed out that the reason that nighttime trials were illegal was because of the difficulty of calling witnesses. They'd all be at home in bed, not even knowing that the trial was occurring. But in the process of Jesus' trial, he was able to call into correction the various officials who were wanting to ignore the concept of witness and were ignoring the rules of evidence that God had established for the nation of Israel. But after those trials were finished in the night, we come to verse 28, and they took Jesus from Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. So we are now going to look at the trial before Pilate. Who is Pilate? Well, let's consider him under the background. You'll want to look at your notes because I don't have the PowerPoint to be able to simplify this a little bit. This passage that we are considering, and actually all the way through chapter 19, will be on the morning of April the 3rd, A.D. 33. This is the date of Jesus' crucifixion. It's important here to notice this is the year 33, because there were events in Pilate's life that made it so that he was especially susceptible to the pressures that he received on this day, and it is in part the reason that he caved in. He became procurator of Judea. That is, he was ruler over the province of Judea, a minor province within the Roman Empire. And he came to power in late AD 26. This is 6.5 years before Jesus was crucified. Now, he had a powerful ally in Rome who was actually his intermediary between himself and the emperor Tiberius, and that was Sejanus. And as long as Sejanus was in power, he could intercept things and make sure that Pilate could do fairly well. But when Pilate went to Judea in late AD 26, he wanted to show that he was a tough guy. So he reinstituted a policy that had been dropped by the Romans several years before. What was that policy? They had brought in banners into the city of Jerusalem. That is, when you have the troops marching in, you know, we would often think of having some flag bearers. Well, they would have banner bearers. And as they were carrying these banners, on them would be pictures of the emperor Tiberius. And you remember the Old Testament's regulations against having images. Well, with that coming into Jerusalem, obviously the Jewish people threw a fit, and they would have riots. Finally, the Romans decided it was not a good idea to have the emperor's likeness on any of the banners that they brought into Jerusalem. And so they abandoned the practice. But right when Pilate took power, one of his first acts was to go from Caesarea into Jerusalem. And what do you think he had? Had banners with the emperor's likeness. Riots began, and they lasted for 5 days. And the riots were getting worse and worse and worse. Finally, Pilate said, "We'll take the banners out of the city." Guess who won round one? The Jewish officials. So much for Pilate showing that he's a tough guy. He caves in. Well, then he issued coins in Judea, and we find reference to these coins. Remember in the passage where the religious officials asked in the Synoptic Gospels if it were legal to pay taxes to Caesar. And you remember what Jesus said. Bring me a coin. And he asks, whose likeness is on this? And they said, Caesar's. And then he said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and render unto God the things that are God's. However, you remember we said that Sejanus was the big powerhouse behind Pilate. Sejanus got himself into a little embarrassing situation. He was tricked into it. And as a result of that, he was executed in the year 32. Well, no longer does Pilate have an advocate for himself up in Rome. And so pretty soon the political pressure comes for there no longer to be the coins with the emperor's likeness. And guess what? In the year 32, they ceased to be produced. Score number two for the Jewish religious officials. Then, number three. He put gold-covered shields on display that did not have the likeness of Caesar, but they had his name, and it may well be that they also had a statement of the deity of the Caesar on them. Well, his rival up in Galilee, Herod Antipas, the Herodian family, and other prominent Jews petitioned to Caesar to have those gilded shields that were on display in Herod the Great's house removed. Now, this was something that Pilate had done, thinking that he might win the favor of Tiberius. And after all, he was having a little competition in getting the favor of Tiberius as opposed to having the favor going to Herod Antipas. But Herod Antipas beat him to the punch. And there was a letter of reprimand, and Pilate removed the gilded shields and sent them off to Caesarea. Well, Annas and Caiaphas, the real high priest and the acting high priest, were very quick to notice that it just required putting a little bit of pressure on Pilate and he would cave in. If there was something really important, they knew that Pilate was bluff, that he would not stand for what it was that he initially went for. That's going to come into play, and that particularly comes into play now after Sejanus is out of power. So with a crucifixion in the year 33, we find Pilate to be especially susceptible to manipulation. The master manipulator is himself manipulated. Let's now start new exposition at verse 28. Early in the morning, the officials that were involved in the trial, before Annas and Caiaphas, brought Jesus to the praetorium without entering, so that defilement would not prevent them from eating the Passover. Verse 28. So they took Jesus from Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning, but they did not enter the headquarters themselves in order that they might not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Now, if you look back at verse 27, we can see some indication of it not being so early in the morning, because remember, Peter had been told that the cock would crow once he had made his three denials, and we have the cock crowing in verse 27. It's early in the morning, but I would assume that it's early in the morning, late enough that Pilate is up and ready to do business. Now, the location of Pilate's household here, Pilate did not normally stay in Jerusalem. He was normally in Caesarea. Now, Caesarea is on the coast, and it would be an easy point for the Romans to resupply with troops and various material. So normally he would be in Caesarea, but since riots had a tendency to happen at the major feasts, he would always come with a contingent of troops from Caesarea and park himself probably in the Antonia. Now, the Antonia was a fortress. It had been built by Herod the Great that was overlooking the temple, overlooking the court of the Gentiles. And so if you went through the colonnades leading out of the temple on the south side, you could walk directly into the Antonia, the fortress, which is where Pilate would headquarter himself, where he would have lots of troops to protect him. And so this is just outside of the temple. So, have an interesting thing that's happening here. They go to meet him, but they will not go inside the praetorium. They will not go inside the Antonia. Now, the closeness of the location where Pilate is, we can see some evidence of that as you look at verse 39 and 40. Pilate, in verse 38b, has gone out to the Judean officials, and they said that he didn't have any capital charges that could be sustained against Jesus. So then he says, you have a custom that I released you one man at the Passover. So do you want me to release the king of the Judeans for you? Then they all shouted back, but the ones that shouted back are the crowds. Now, where can you have crowds gathering outside of the Roman procurator's home without having it look like they are a hand-selected group of people? How do you have it not look like they were people, that they were shills that were chosen by the high priest at the temple itself? It's going to be very important here that they look like just ordinary people, rather than looking like specifically ones that would have been allied with the high priests. So this location is right next to the temple. Now there's an interesting irony in verse 28. The officials here would not go inside the headquarters, and the reason that they didn't is so that they wouldn't be defiled and prevented from eating the Passover, which would be later that day. It would be a one-day defilement, so if they missed out, then they'd have to wait 1 month until the backup Passover feast was served. Did you know that such a thing existed? So many people manage to get defiled by coming into contact with some flour, some yeast, or this or that or the other thing that they set up an alternate day. But, you know, if you're one of the big honchos, you don't want to show up at the backup feast. You want to be there for the real one. And so they didn't want to do something that would end up with them being defiled. Everyone would know that they had gone into the household of Pilate, and so they avoided going in. Pilate was inclined to accommodate the officials at times like this because he really didn't want them to get too angry at him, because he knew what riots were like. He'd experienced them before. So it was a time when he would be willing to come out and to meet them outside of the praetorium and then lead Jesus in for the trial. But isn't it interesting? They wanted to avoid defilement, and yet they were plotting to kill Jesus. Jesus had asked on an earlier occasion that's recorded in the Synoptics, when he had healed a man on the Sabbath, and the religious leaders were then plotting his death, he said, is it legal to make alive or to kill on the Sabbath? They were wanting to try him and put him to death for healing someone, and they thought that he was breaking the Sabbath regulations, but what were they doing? We're going to see that there was a fair amount of premeditation that had happened. Well, Pilate came out, verse 29, and he asked what the charge was against Jesus, and in so doing, he opened a new trial. Notice verse 29. Then Pilate came out to them and said, what charge do you bring against this man? Now, as you read that, does it sound like Pilate is saying, okay, yeah, I know why you brought him, and I'll try him on those charges that you brought him here for? Does it sound like anything's prearranged? No, it doesn't. Well, actually, there was something going on. Let's look back at chapter 18, verse 3. We'll back up to verse 1, actually. When Jesus had said these things, he went out with his disciples across the Kidron Ravine, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now, Judas, his betrayer, also knew the place, because Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas took a detachment of soldiers and some temple police from the chief priests and Pharisees, and came there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. Now drop down further into the passage, and we also note that in verse 12, then the detachment of soldiers, the captain, and the Jewish temple police arrested Jesus and tied him up. The Romans are involved, are they not? Now, how does it happen that the Romans would be involved sending a detachment without Pilate knowing? Okay, Pilate already knows, doesn't he? Pilate has been brought up to speed, and there's a simple reason for this. Yes, they could have gone out and sought to arrest Jesus, that is, the Jewish officials, with the temple police. But there always was the possibility that Jesus would put up a fight, that his disciples would fight. Now, after all, we know that Peter had a dagger, did he not? Probably some of the others did as well. They wanted the Romans to be implicated in anything in order to shield themselves against popular opinion, which there were a lot of people that were very much in favor of Jesus. In order to get the cooperation of the Romans, they would need to say, this man is a revolutionary, which is ultimately the charge that they brought against him. They had to convince Pilate that he was dangerous and that they needed to send out an armed contingent to arrest him. So, with that in mind, now let's look at what Pilate is saying in verse 29. Okay, what have you brought this guy in here for? What he's saying is, all bets are off on our previous agreements. See, up until that point, they thought that basically Pilate was ready to cave in and ready to go ahead and try Jesus on the charges that they had brought against him. But now he's saying, okay, what's he here for? And we're starting out from ground zero. With that, the Judean officials told Pilate essentially that, well, wait a moment, let's go back to our original deal. We already told you what he's being charged with. We don't need to open a new trial. You just need to pursue the line of evidence that we've already given you. In verse 30, the officials, having already met with Pilate, bristled that he did not seem to be prepared to follow through on their agreement. They tried to steer Pilate back to the previous charge. Verse 30, in reply, they said, if this man were not a criminal, we would not have handed him over to you. We've already talked this all over. Come on, Pilate. You know what the deal is. Just go forward. Just do all the things, you know, just take care of this. They've already had the previous meetings, and Pilate isn't wanting to be particularly cooperative. So, Pilate shows further that he doesn't have any intention of cooperating with them. After all, he knows that they are seeking to get him to do their dirty work for him, for them. And so he says in verse 31, something to say, no, I'm not going to cooperate. Pilate, who knew that Jesus did not resist arrest. After all, it was his troops that were involved in the arrest. Nullified their prior agreement. So they should try Jesus, who Pilate perceived as no threat to Rome. But they said no, they couldn't, because they lacked capital authority. They couldn't execute him. So therefore, they gave the case back to Pilate. Verse 31. So Pilate told them, you take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. Therefore, the Judean said to him, it is not lawful for us to put anyone to death. Pilate's essentially saying, he does not seem to be a threat to Rome. The only incident that happened was had one hothead who managed to cut off the ear of a Jewish servant. That was no threat to Rome. Jesus told him, put your dagger back, and there were no further incidents. Pilate says, we were being prepared for having to go arrest this dangerous revolutionary who we had to bring all sorts of weapons and had to have a large contingent, and he doesn't look like a revolutionary. You take care of him. Pilate was smart enough to say, I think I'm being used here. I think I'm being set up. It was enough that I had to pay overtime to those troops. No, we're not going to have any court expenses. You take care of him yourself. But then they said, well, we can't execute him. Well, why are they wanting to execute him? Pilate knows that the real charges are religious or jealousy rather than the political charges, which is the way that they had expressed them to Pilate. Now notice, they said that they lacked capital authority. They could not put anyone to death. The only circumstance where they had the power of death under the Roman administration was if someone crossed into the court of the women who was not Jewish. The Romans held things like capital punishment very close. That was something that they would not delegate out to provincials. That was something that they reserved for themselves. That was a prerequisite of the Roman governing authorities. That doesn't mean that mob violence wasn't used at times. Remember in Acts chapter 6 and 7 where Stephen gives his message and he was stoned, and that was by the Sanhedrin, by the ruling authorities. Remember how Saul held the cloaks of those who were actually throwing the stones. So, it's a very important point here that is now made in verse 32. The fact that the Jews would not be the ones killing him meant that Jesus would not be stoned, but he would be crucified. He was not a Roman citizen. So in verse 32, John tells us that this fulfills Jesus' prediction of the type of death he would face: crucifixion, not stoning. Let's turn back to John chapter 12. Verses 32 and 33. And as for me, if I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw all peoples to myself. Now this, he said, to indicate what kind of death he was about to die. The crowd answered him, "We have heard from the law that the Christ remains forever. So how can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is the Son of Man?" Something very interesting. John tells us in an editorial remark that Jesus says this about himself being lifted up to signify the kind of death that he would die. He's lifted up on a cross where people are having to look up at him rather than being stoned where bones would be broken and he would be down on the ground with a monument piled up over him. John gives that to us as an editorial remark. Now, he said this to indicate what kind of death he was about to die, but it's clear that the crowd also understood him to be referring to crucifixion, did they not? Because what do they say? You're talking about dying. You're talking about dying, and that means that the Son of Man that you're talking about can't be the Messiah, because the Messiah is going to reign forever. The thing that they failed to understand, and the thing also that Jesus' disciples failed to understand, was that he would reign forever, but before that would happen, he would die. They thought that it was a contradiction. They couldn't reconcile it. But Jesus spoke of the kind of death that he was about to die. He also said that not one bone would be broken, which stoning, of course, broke bones. Crucifixion did not. Why is this important? Why is it that John brings this to our attention? Or even more pointedly, why is it that Jesus himself indicated the type of death that he was about to die? Why was this important? Think back to John chapter 2, verse 19. In John 2:19, Jesus said, "Destroy this sanctuary, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And John tells us again that he was speaking about the sanctuary of his body. Jesus demonstrates himself to be the Christ, the one sent by the Father, because he knows exactly what is going to happen to him. He is able to predict it down to the very smallest of details, because everything that he does is according to God the Father's plan. He is demonstrating that he is not haphazardly guessing. He knows what's going to happen. Who is it that knows the future from the beginning? God. Jesus knows the future from the beginning. All the way through this book, Jesus has been demonstrating who he is. But besides that, we saw that in the last discourse, is not Jesus preparing his disciples for that ministry that they will face when he is gone and he's in the presence of the Father? He's going to send another advocate to be with them as they're essentially alone in the world, and they're going to have to stand up courageously and minister with the whole world being opposed to them. And the last discourse is the preparation that the good shepherd gives for his own that they can minister on his behalf. There was no plan B. What would have happened if Jesus' 11 had failed? What would have happened if they all decided to return to fishing? What's plan B? There is no plan B. They had to succeed. Jesus had to prepare them for that which they would face. And in part, he does that by giving them clues about the things that are going to be happening a little way down the road. He predicts that Peter is going to deny him 3 times. He predicts that Judas is going to betray him. He predicts that the high priests are going to turn him over to the Romans. He predicts his crucifixion. He predicts his resurrection. All the way through, Jesus is doing what he's been doing throughout this book. Turn ahead a couple pages to a very familiar passage at the bottom of page 66 in your Living Water. Verse 30. Jesus actually performed many other miraculous signs besides the crucifixion and resurrection in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these 8 signs are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Everything in this book is designed to demonstrate who Jesus is, the life-giving Messiah, the one who guarantees everlasting life to those who believe in him for it. And that is something Jesus doesn't lose sight of. John doesn't lose sight of it either. And so therefore, John in chapter 18, verse 32, gives the reader the reminder that Jesus, because of who he is, the Christ, the Son of God, could predict and did predict his death and the type of death that he would die. Now, what do you think the odds are? Normally, when the Jewish officials had someone that they needed to get rid of, how did they do it? Was it normal for them to arrange for the Romans to crucify the person? Is that their normal procedure? No. Their normal procedure was to stone them. Let's back up. Look in John, chapter 8. Jesus has spoken some very sharp words identifying exactly what's going on with his opponents in the temple back on the Feast of Booths in the year 32. And in verse 59, the last verse of chapter 8, "Therefore they picked up stones to throw at him. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple courts, going through the midst of them, and so passed by." What form of death did they want to put him to? Stoning. And this would have been too early, because this would have been prior to the close of the prophecy that Daniel had made in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 27. It was not until Palm Sunday of the year 33 that Jesus could be crucified. How many times in John's gospel does he say, "My time has not yet come"? He knows when and how he's going to die. And John gives a reminder. And the reason he knows how and when he's going to die is because of who he is. The Christ, the Son of God. Well, what did Pilate do when the Judean officials told him that they were handing Jesus over to them, or over to Pilate? They weren't going to take jurisdiction because they didn't have capital authority. Well, in verse 33, Pilate went inside and questioned Jesus, specifically, "Are you king of the Judeans?" So in verse 33 it says, "Then Pilate went back into the headquarters, called Jesus, and said to him, 'Are you king of the Judeans?'" This is a restatement of the charges that were brought against Jesus. Remember what happened when Jesus was crucified? Pilate made a little inscription, didn't he? And he said, "The King of the Judeans." And the religious officials saw it, and what did they want him to do? Change it. He said that he's King of the Judeans. Pilate said, "What I said, or what I've written, I have written." Wow, you know, he sounds like a steadfast person who never changes his mind. What an odd set of words for a man like Pilate to utter. But the charge that was brought against Jesus was he claims to be king. Since he claims to be king, obviously he's against Rome. He's a threat to Rome. So Pilate starts out with a question related to the charge. "Are you the king? Are you the king over the Judeans? What do you think about Tiberius Caesar? Is he their king?" Yeah, you can see where the line of questioning is going to go. Well, in verse 34, Jesus asks a very pointed question. Was this Pilate's own question, or was it the Judean authorities' question? In other words, was Pilate asking this on his own because of his own curiosity, or was he asking it because he was told about it by others? Verse 34, Jesus answered him, "Are you saying this on your own, or have others told you about me?" This is an extremely important question that Jesus has asked him. One of the better illustrations that I can think of that might give this a direction, if it were on Pilate's own initiative, Jesus would have proceeded one way in talking with him. But if it came from the religious authorities, he would approach it a different way. There was a little boy who came up to his mother and said, "What is sex?" And the mother proceeded to give a rather long and detailed explanation. And then the boy said, "Well, Miss Smith just asked me what the sex was of our puppy." Notice how much it changes what the question is. Jesus wanted to know, "Pilate, have you been observing some of what's going on and you're trying to make sense of who I am?" In other words, has this raised some questions in your mind? Jesus would approach him one way. But on the other hand, if all that he's heard is what he's been spoon-fed by the religious authorities, it's a completely different answer that Pilate needs. So Jesus is wanting to find out from Pilate what exactly prompted the question. Is it something going on within Pilate, or is it something going on within the religious leaders? Now, Jesus knew full well what was going on in Pilate's mind, but Jesus wanted for Pilate to articulate. Jesus gave him the opportunity to say, "Yes, this is a serious question. Could you please help me figure you out?" Or, "It's not a serious question. I just want to find out if I should put you to death." See, the question becomes, did Pilate want life from Jesus, or did he just want to find out whether Jesus deserved death? Notice how big a difference it is between whether Pilate is asking a serious question or he's asking a question because the religious authorities have spoon-fed him. So, Pilate gives an answer. His answer comes in the form of a question. Pilate retorted that he is not a Judean, so of course it's not his own question. But he wants to know what Jesus has done that has prompted his own nation and high priest to betray him to Pilate. Verse 35, Pilate replied, "I am not a Judean, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests handed you over to me. What have you done?" Now, the word here for handed over is a word that is quite regularly used of betray. And that's not at all out of keeping with what's going on here. Pilate says, "I'm not used to receiving all of this help and all this wonderful advice and assistance from the religious authorities who want to have me try you. And I don't believe that the charges that they're giving, that they're telling me, are the whole story. I know that they're trying to manipulate me. What is it that you've done that got them so angry at you that they want me to put you to death?" Pilate knows that they have their own mafia. They have their own Sicilians. They have their own ways of taking care of things. Pilate says, How did you get them so angry at them, at you? "Your own nation and chief priests betrayed you over to me. You got to help me out. How in the world did you get them so ticked off? How did that happen?" He says, "I haven't seen this one before." He must think, well, Jesus didn't take very good lessons from Dale Carnegie on how to win friends and influence enemies. Because Jesus has definitely made some enemies. And it's quite clear how he did it. Look back at what Jesus said in speaking with Annas. Back up to earlier in John chapter 18. Actually, this is before Caiaphas. Verse 19. Then the high priest, Caiaphas, questioned him about his... That's Annas. Because in verse 24, they sent him on to Caiaphas. Annas, let me give a little bit of background. Annas was the real high priest, but he was deposed by the Romans in the year 15. But after that, for the rest of his life, his five sons and his son-in-law, Caiaphas, each in turn served as the high priest. So Caiaphas is the acting high priest that the Romans recognize. But who's the power behind Caiaphas? It's Annas. And so Jesus first appears before Annas. And so, therefore, you notice that in verse 19, Annas is called high priest, and you drop down to verse 24, and Caiaphas is also called high priest. It's because Caiaphas was the acting high priest at that period of time, but the real powerhouse, who, since high priests were appointed how long? For life. Would have been regarded as the high priest, even though the Romans didn't regard him as high priest. Now notice what Jesus said when Annas questioned about him, his disciples, and about his teaching. I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in the synagogues and in the temple courts where the Judeans always congregate, and have spoken nothing in secret. He said, I didn't have a public agenda and then a secret one. I spoke openly. And when Jesus spoke openly, he managed to get the religious authorities to want to kill him on a regular basis. So, Pilate wants to know, how did you make them so angry at you? It must be especially puzzling because did Jesus resist arrest? It's, wait a moment, in some ways you look like a nobody. But you can't be a nobody. Because you've gotten them all upset at you and they haven't been able to knock you off. Pilate is really wondering about this. How did this happen? It's very simple. Jesus is who he says he is. And his time hadn't yet come, so even though he didn't have a big army around him, he was safe up until it was time for him to be delivered up. Well, Jesus needs to give a careful answer. And this answer that he gives in verse 36 has been widely misunderstood, so we're going to need to look at it fairly closely. Jesus said that his kingdom is not of this world because if it were, his disciples would be fighters that would not have allowed the Judeans to arrest him. My kingdom is not of this world, Jesus answered. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I wouldn't be handed over to the Judeans. But in fact, my kingdom does not have its source here. Notice Jesus was very careful not to say to be turned over to the Romans. Says to be turned over to the Judeans. His servants would have fought, and the Judeans would have not had the upper hand, and they were the ones, obviously, who handed him over to Pilate. A lot of people have understood this, and a lot of our hymns talk about Jesus making his reigning in our heart. Yeah, you hear all kinds of things like that. And people think of the kingdom now instead of understanding it to be future, understanding it to be the millennium. Jesus is not denying the millennium. He is not denying the eternal reign on earth. He is doing nothing of the sort. But he's saying, my kingdom does not come in by ordinary means. No, Pilate, you don't have to worry about me gathering up an army to try to fight against you. Jesus was not in the business right now of establishing militias. But what's going to happen at the second advent? The world will see him come with an army that will astound them. And what he's saying is, I don't need to recruit an army from those here on earth. No, you don't have to worry about that. You look at my disciples and you're not seeing warriors. If that were the way that I was going to come to power, I would have been setting about creating an army. And if I had created an army, the Judeans would not have been able to arrest me. But I allowed myself to be arrested, did I not? And Pilate knows that full well. And Pilate's saying, this is not an ordinary revolutionary. In fact, I don't think he's revolutionary at all. Basically, what Jesus is saying is, you don't have to worry about me trying to undermine the Roman authorities. Is Jesus saying he won't come with military power? No. But what he's saying is his military power isn't going to come from planet Earth. His military power is going to come of the legions of angels and of resurrected saints. His power, his kingdom, will be set up as he leads his armies that weren't sourced on planet Earth. Notice he's given Pilate a truthful answer, but could Pilate have given an explanation of how Jesus is going to come to power? No. Jesus just told him what he's not doing, and he gave him sufficient evidence for Pilate to say, yeah, I don't think you're coming in the normal way. And Pilate thinks, this guy must be deluded. But Pilate concludes, Jesus is no threat. In other words, Pilate says, the Judean officials have come up with a trumped-up case. Well, Pilate pursues the questioning a little further. So in verse 37, he asks him a follow-up question. And in that follow-up question, he asks, since Jesus did speak of a kingdom, is he a king? Jesus said that Pilate has said it himself. Jesus was born and came into the world to testify to the truth. Those who are of the truth hear him. Verse 37, so Pilate said to him, are you a king then? You say that I am a king, Jesus replied. For this I was born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Notice where Pilate gets the idea to follow up by asking, you are a king then. He's drawing an inference. And look back at what Jesus had said in verse 36. My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, but in fact, my kingdom does not have its source here. Jesus has referred to his kingdom on three occasions in one very short answer. Isn't it natural for Pilate to say, well, if you have a kingdom, then you must be a king, right? And so Jesus gives explanation. He said, you said it. And that's another way of him saying, yes, indeed I am. And he said, I was born for this purpose. And I've come into the world to testify to the truth. And one significant aspect of Jesus' truth that he came to proclaim is that he is the king. What is it that this book's purpose statement tells us is the crux of the message? Jesus is the life-giving, messianic Son of God. He is the Christ, the Son of God. By believing this, you may have life in his name. The Messiah is a king. Jesus said, you said it yourself. He said, I don't need to say it. You've already said it. Jesus is not being evasive. He's not trying to say, well, you said it, I didn't. He's saying, you said it. Is it like Jesus to be evasive on something like this? Does he deny what the Father sent him to do? No way. He's affirming what the Father sent him to be. You said it. And I was born for this very purpose, and I have come into the world to testify to the truth. And that truth is that he is God sent to be the messianic deliverer who would grant everlasting life to believers. He's the Son of God who does this. Well, Pilate has a quick response in verse 38a. He scoffed at Jesus' claim to represent truth, and he walked out. I would, in order to make this point, I'm going to read it a little differently than it's paragraphed here in your text. Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he said this, he went out to the Judeans again and told them. Notice what happens. Pilate asks the question. Does Pilate want an answer? No way. Pilate walks out of there immediately. He's scoffing at the concept of there being truth. Pilate's a man who vacillates, is he not? Now, he told the religious officials, what I wrote, I have written. We can't change the inscription on that cross. But Pilate changes his mind very easily. He's a man who comes across with a lot of bravado, but he caves in very easily. And he says, if you've got truth, I don't have any interest in hearing it from you. He's answering more eloquently than he did the first time when Jesus asked, if you back up to verse 33, are you king of the Judeans? Jesus asked, are you saying this on your own, or have others told you about me? Pilate's saying very clearly, I'm not interested in you. I'm not interested in your truth. I'm not interested in any of this. Just let me wash my hands of all of this, and I'll be happy. Which, of course, we know later on he did. Literally, he washed his hands. But he didn't really free himself of it. So then in verse 39, Pilate referred to his custom of releasing one prisoner. Oh, let's see, actually, 38b. Pilate reported to the Judean officials that he exonerated Jesus. This should have ended the matter. After he had said, what is truth? Verse 38b, and when he had said this, he went out to the Judeans again and told them, I find absolutely no grounds for charging him. Case dismissed. That should have ended it. But Pilate is a man who can be manipulated. So, unfortunately, ones who think that they can be manipulated tend to be the ones who themselves are manipulated. In verse 39, he's going to try to manipulate the Judean authorities. He's going to get a dig at them, but in the process, he sets himself up for a fall. Rather than saying, I find absolutely no grounds for charging him, this is going no further, he played their game. He said, but you have a custom that I release one man to you at the Passover, so do you want me to release the king of the Judeans for you? Pilate referred to the custom of releasing one prisoner at Passover and apparently hoping that the crowds would disagree with the leaders. He asked if he should release the king of the Judeans. Pilate would not be unaware of the large crowds that had appeared 1 week before on Palm Sunday, almost a week, welcoming Jesus and putting out cloaks, palm branches, and saying praises to Jesus. He knows that there is a big popular following, and he knows that that jealousy underlies much of what the religious officials have against Jesus. And there he is saying, here we are, standing in front of the temple, all these people gathered in the court of the Gentiles, besides these religious officials that he's talking to. So he just raises his voice loudly enough that the crowd in the immediate vicinity can hear. And he's figuring that they're going to outvote the religious authorities. And they're going to say, well, of course, we want our king. We want Jesus to be released. But what we have instead is a crowd that I think is largely favorable to the temple authorities. Wouldn't be at all surprised if they had something to do with the composition of the people who were standing nearby. Do you want me to release the king of the Judeans for you? Notice how he tried to make a dig at the religious officials. That's why he said this. He didn't say, do you want me to release Jesus to you? Do you want me to release your king to you? And he knew what answer the religious authorities would give, didn't he? But Pilate fully expects that the crowds are going to say, oh, we want our king. Release Jesus. But instead, they all shouted back, not this fellow, but Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a bandit. More appropriately, he was an insurrectionist. Isn't this interesting? Here we have an actual insurrectionist being released. When what was the charge against Jesus? He was an insurrectionist. And so we have the religious authorities being all worked up. Well, we've got to make sure that insurrectionists are put to death. And what do they end up getting the crowds to ask for? The release of an insurrectionist. Notice how this shows what a sham the justice system is. Was. They had tried someone who was innocent and found him guilty, and they're finding someone who was guilty innocent. Isn't that interesting? Direct reversal on the same charge. What we see in this passage can be very much summed up by a bulldog. Winston Churchill never, never, never give in. Jesus stood for the truth despite what it cost. But look at all the other players in here. All the other players have their own agendas. Pilate wants to look strong and tough in front of the religious authorities. But what does he do? He plays their game. He tries to manipulate them. And instead, he's manipulated. He's going to be manipulated further as the passage continues. the religious authorities. They wanted to be nice and pure and pristine and able to eat the Passover. And what do? They hold illegal trial at night, and they trump up charges against an innocent man so that he will be put to death. Everything is turned upside down. But what we see is Jesus standing for truth. Who else in this passage stands for truth? Not one of them. As a person reads John's gospel, John shows the truth. Jesus Christ guarantees everlasting life to those who believe in him for it. And of course, he gives fantastic evidence that Jesus is qualified as the Son of God, the Messiah, to deliver on his promise. This book stands for truth. The objective reader sees the truth that Jesus is the life giver. He's not the death giver who is unfocused and embracing the lie. Jesus wants the reader to embrace the truth, believe in Jesus, and he will give everlasting life. Jesus said in John 5:24, "Truly, truly, I say to you, he who hears my words and believes in him who sent me has everlasting life, shall not come into judgment, but has passed from death into life." Right now, we're alive physically, but one who has believed in Jesus Christ is guaranteed to live forever, never to die, and will never appear at the great white throne. Why do unbelievers show up at the great white throne? John tells us, and Revelation tells us, that it is so that they can see if their works are good enough to give them life. And guess what? Nobody's works will be good enough to grant them life. So only one way to receive everlasting life, and that is Jesus Christ is the one who guarantees everlasting life to those who believe in him for it. Shall we pray?